Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor for Neurology Live. In this episode, I sat down with Dr. Barry Hendon, a clinical professor at the University of Arizona, the director of the MS Clinic at Banner University Medical Center, and the chief medical officer of the MS Association of America, to talk about World MS Day, which just passed and was celebrated on May 30th. He shared his perspective on awareness efforts like World MS Day, the impact that they've had on care, and how treatment has evolved in the past two decades. Let's dive in.
Hendon, neurologist in Phoenix, Arizona. I wear a few hats. That is, I'm a clinical professor at University of Arizona, and I run the MS clinic at the Banner University Medical Center. I have a practice at MS Center of Arizona, and I'm chief medical officer for MSAA, which is the MS Association of America. I think anytime that you have the opportunity to increase awareness about this area that I care so much about, MS, it's a good thing. And I think that the idea behind the World MS Awareness Day really is that it's a world awareness, and that is to connect, not just that that the people in the U.S. or North America are aware, because we have other occasions to be aware, but it's about the connectivity, and that is that we recognize that we're not just part of a small community, that we're part of a worldwide community. And so if you look at the participants, it's not just the National MS Society, US, but it's societies all around the globe. It tells us that this isn't just a problem located in a place, but that it really is worldwide. It's the connectivity that I think is the important level of awareness.
And do you think that helps when you, that sort of the push toward, you know, bringing awareness to, like you said, this is something that affects people on a global scale. There are physicians all over the world treating this. There are patients obviously all over the world, you know, dealing with this disease. Do you think that that helps when it comes to sort of patient communication and getting support for patients? I would imagine getting an MS diagnosis and dealing with it is probably not exactly an easy thing to do. How important is that connectiveness for patients?
Well, I would sort of take it on a couple levels. And on one level, again, the whole concept for the World MS Day is that we are connected globally. And so for me, that is the big deal. And that is that you are part of a worldwide community. It's broad. Now, if you said, does it change the individual life of an individual patient? I think there are a lot of organizations that contribute to awareness in the U.S. And I'm thinking of three in particular, although there are more. I'm thinking of MS Association of America. I'm thinking of the Consortium of MS Centers. I'm thinking of National MS Society. And in saying that, I'm really telling you that it seems that all of us believe that the more we can heighten awareness and the more we can connect to our local institutions and our local providers, but also the more that we can make people aware that it's not just our issue, but worldwide. I think it's more about the value of more voices and more connectivity.
And then obviously MS is a field, you know, there's been a good amount of clinical development of therapeutics over the last decade, 20 years even, and things are still, you know, sort of constantly ramping up. There's a lot of research now being done into what we can do to try to tackle progressive MS better, as I'm sure you're very aware. For you, how has the state of care sort of changed, and what role has awareness and efforts like this sort of played in that, in sort of getting the ball rolling and getting more options for patients?
Well, the first thing to remember is I've been a neurologist for a long time. And when I came into neurology, there were no disease-modifying therapies whatsoever. So if you had MS, we could educate, we could diagnose, but we couldn't change the trajectory of MS until 1993. So in 1993, we had one medication. In the early 90s, we increased that to a few medications. They were four relapsing forms of MS, and the really gratifying part of being able to maintain an MS practice is how it's evolved and how much more is offered to clinicians treating MS, but more importantly, to people with MS. And so we've been able to change. Sometimes people say, what is it about MS that interests you? And I, my fairly routine answer, besides the explosion of knowledge, is the ability to change the trajectory of a life. And so if you said, are we getting better and better at treating relapsing forms of MS? Have we gone from zero meds to a few meds to more than 20 meds? Absolutely. If you said with regards to progressive, I think we're best at treating the inflammatory part of MS. We think that we have not been as successful in treating progression in MS, but that's one of the reasons that a lot of attention has been placed on treating progressive forms of MS, and particularly what we call active progressive MS. And I think, as you know, Mazent has been a large part of that. It's not that there is a single medication, but rather that the trials that involved Mazent were trials that I think were important for getting rid of the nihilism about progressive MS. And so up to that point in time, there had been a great deal of nihilism based on some of the French literature stating that once you reached a certain level of disability, there wasn't much you could do. I think that the Mazent trial was most important for me as a clinician in showing that in a population with more severe MS, older population, longer duration, that there was still a lot we could do to change the trajectory. So for me, it was a way of challenging successfully the nihilism that is, sure, you could do something early on, but not when there's progression. I think the belief now, based on a lot of data, is that when there's active secondary progressive MS, there's more we should do and can.
Absolutely. And you know, obviously, you mentioned Mazent and siponimod, obviously being the non-brand name, but we got a number of sort of cogs rolling in that progressive area, and there are some therapies and some avenues being explored. I'm curious for you in that portion of disease, the progressive phase where we're really kind of, you know, like you mentioned, struggling to sort of hit the mark and address it the way we're able to address relapsing MS. What are you keeping your eye on? What's showing promise for you, and what are you kind of expecting in the next, you know, few years?
So for me, although there's always been a discussion in MS as to whether late progression represented the failure of sufficient therapy early, or whether progression was inevitable independent of successful early treatment. I think that the literature tells us that the primary engine driving late progression is the failure to treat effectively early. And so for me, the first thing that I think is important is this concept that early treatment with effective agents is our best shot at reducing late disability. That's a principle that doesn't go away for me at all. The second part is, I think we still are looking, I mean, most of the agents we use, virtually all the agents we're using for relapsing MS, are approved for active secondary progressive MS. The question really is, is there something we can do that is reparative or restorative for later MS, non-active? So far, although we are, I've participated in trials and keeping my eye on trials of reparative strategies, restorative strategies, those are still a while away from fruition.
And now, you know, you alluded to to this sort of, without mentioning it, but alluded to the sort of induction versus escalation discussion that had been ongoing for quite a while. It does seem that, you know, that everyone's kind of landed that higher efficacy as early as possible is probably the best way to go. Is that where you stay? Do you think that, quote unquote, that sort of debate is kind of over? Obviously, there are certain patients, I would imagine, where, you know, you don't necessarily need to start them on something extraordinarily high efficacy, but you shook your head no. So is that?
I'll give you an answer. It's an important concept, and so I don't think the debate has ended. I think in academic centers there is a greater tendency to start higher efficacy agents early, and then in the community there is a greater tendency to start with simpler agents and then escalate late. I think in some ways it also may be a false binary, so that if you ask people what they're actually doing, they may not want to place themselves in either category of escalators or early use of high efficacy treaters, but rather say that they treat the individual patient in front of them, and that if it looks like a good prognosis patient, they'll start with something lower, and if it looks like a poor prognosis patient, they'll start something higher. One of the reasons that I have philosophically been in favor of starting higher efficacy agents early is that although for populations we have prognostic data, for the individual in front of us, the N of one, our ability to predict that individual's course when we see them first time around is actually not very good. And so we may think we know who is a good prognosis patient, and we may think we know who is a poor prognosis patient. And I think that in populations we may, but for individuals we don't, and that therefore it is a safety effort to treat the higher efficacy or use the higher efficacy agents early. In that regard, two things. I mean, my comment is that I overtreat the few to protect the many. I recognize that some people would have done well even on low efficacy agents. I just don't know who they are. And so I'll tend, although I use all the agents, my philosophy and tendency is to prefer the higher efficacy agents. Additionally, in the past, as you moved up from lower efficacy agents to higher efficacy agents, you dealt with more immunosuppressive risk. I think we've achieved a time when we can move to higher efficacy agents without incurring additional immunosuppressive hazard. And so my view is, number one, I can move up from lesser agents to better agents without a significant increase in risk. And all those things compel me toward the earlier use of high efficacy agents.
Yeah, fingers crossed, you know, as the push for individualized and personalized medicine, you know, moves on its way, fingers crossed we get to that point, and then that prognostication effort will at that point hopefully be much easier. The last question I have for you is, how important, when you're talking about, you know, potential administration approaches, you know, the different types of ways therapies can be administered, whether you're going to go with something higher efficacy versus something, you know, a little lighter on the patient, how much of that conversation is based on the patient's needs versus the prognosis for their disease?
So within each of the categories, what I would call the high efficacy or the lower efficacy, the middle efficacy, and the high efficacy, there are choices and choices of vehicle. So there are three people trying to make that decision. It is the clinician, it is the patient, and it is also the payer. But to the extent that that the clinician and person with MS can collaboratively decide, I think it's very important that the patient have a voice in saying, for example, I can tolerate this, but I can't tolerate that in terms of vehicle. I can tolerate this, but I can't tolerate that in terms of side effect profile. I can tolerate this, but I can't tolerate that in terms of risk. And so it has to be collaborative, both because of the need for a strong patient voice, but also if you don't do it, things tend not to work very well. If the person in front of you doesn't agree with your choice, it won't happen, or it won't persist, it won't endure.
Listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.